Hey y'all, and welcome to Baywide Season 2 of Baywide. I'm calling it Season 2 to make it seem like I intentionally haven't released an episode in the past 2 months, but I'm just gonna move on right along like it didn't happen. So anyway, we don't really have that much to talk about what's even been happening in the last couple months news related, because I feel like I've already touched base on it all in the past episodes. So I'll just real quickly give you an idea of what's been happening in the Chesapeake Bay since we've been gone, and really, it's just a continuation of what we heard before. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation released a State of the Bay report, which they do every 2 years, and basically they encapsulated about 13 different parameters on the Chesapeake Bay and its health for the year 2018, and in context, 2016, the overall grade on a massive scale, you know, like, we're never going to get the John Smith days, so we're just going to call it a 70 out of 100, like, totally great in passing. Anyway, the grade was a C- then. This time, 2018, it is a D+. So why, oh why, have we gotten a worse grade? The first time the grade has gone down in the past decade. Well, it's been a lot of things I've already talked about before in previous episodes. We've had twice the amount of rainfall that we typically get. We got about 72 inches recorded at BWI, which is kind of like the record keeper for the Baltimore area. And a lot of that was in the summer months, which are typically drier months. So the water clarity was a lot cloudier. And we also had crazy amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus, all of that. You know, so tons more sediment, tons more nutrients, makes bigger dead zones, makes everything not go as planned. And so, really, it's just a minor step back. I'm not too worried about it. I almost thought about not even bringing it up, but in case you were curious about it, it's the state of the Chesapeake Bay right now. A slight detour, slight dip. And climate change is coming more into fruition. We're seeing that as a grim reality that is going to affect the area. A new report from the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science that was released in December said that there's an outside chance the sea level rise could exceed 5.2 feet, but that's like a 1 in 20 chance. So basically, we're looking at what Maryland is likely going to see by 2100, and it's going to be an increase in 2 and 4.2 feet. That's about 2 to 4 times the rate that we saw last century, you know, the 20th century. So it's definitely going to be increased. But, you know, good news if we meet the commitments that were made by like every single country, including the United States, even though we backed out of it now. The sea level rise would, it still rise, but it would rise at a slower rate with a likely increase ranging from 1.2 to 3 feet. And there's like a 1 in 20 chance that the increase could exceed 3.7 feet. So it's good and bad news, according to Don Bosch, who is the lead badass of like everything, but he's also the author and report and former UMSCES, University of Maryland Center for Estuarine Science, president. So the bad news, he says, is that there's more evidence that unless we really limit warming to the Paris Agreement level, sea level rise could be higher than we thought. The good news is that if we're on the emissions pathway that got us to the Paris Agreement, it's much more manageable. So there you go, there's two big things happening with the Bay, but we're going to go way back before sea level rise was even an issue outlined by anyone, back in the revolutionary days, in this episode that's all about the Battle of the Chesapeake. If it wasn't for the Chesapeake, you'd still be British. That's right, I said it. Yet another reason to be thankful for the Chesapeake Bay is the decisive naval battle in the Revolutionary War that became known as the Battle of the Chesapeake. This battle allowed for the famous siege of Yorktown and the consequent surrender of the British General Cornwallis to even be possible. And you might remember this from grade school, the Cornwallis surrender in October of 1781 essentially secured the victory for the underdog colonists against their mother empire of Britain, where Britain and all of British Parliament were like, these guys are causing way too many problems. Let's just bail and go. All of it started because of the Battle of Chesapeake. And yeah, you should be grateful for the story I'm about to tell you now. And for the Chesapeake Bay, none of it would have happened if it wasn't for the Battle of Chesapeake. I'll outline that situation and the battle that ensued in the next 10 minutes of this podcast. Here we go. So at this late phase of the battle, the American colonists had successfully begged the French to join the war. And the French Navy was really what the colonists were looking for, to change the tide of the war. But they also had a large army helping out, so, you know, thank you, French Navy and Army. That was an incidental pun, by the way, the whole turning the tide thing. Most of the French Navy was chilling in the West Indies, protecting the French assets there. And they were also regrouping, you know, they're sipping pina coladas, and they were just waiting to hear where they should head. And there are two options at this stage in the game, New York or the Chesapeake. These were the two primary strongholds that the British had, and in Virginia, the British were led by General Earl Cornwallis, and they arrived in late May to start the first significant Virginia portion of the Revolutionary War. Cornwallis marched on over to Williamsburg, where he got a message from his boss man, General Sir Henry Clinton, up in New York. And the message just said, "Listen, man, I need you to establish a fortified deep water port so that you can get resupplies by sea. And, you know, also if you have to bail, you can just get on these ships and get out of there." So Cornwallis looked around and he decided to move to Yorktown. And this was late July by the time that his army began fortifying the area. George Washington, first president, leader of the Continental Army, all that. He was doing his finest and really wanted to go to New York because he saw what was happening over at Yorktown, and that was a stronghold. It was well defended, and even if he attacked Yorktown, the British would just dip out by sea because the whole point of Yorktown was that it was a deep water port. So his buddy leading the French army, I'm going to butcher his name, Comte de Roquemaire. I'm gonna look it up for you guys. Let's just call him Jean Baptiste, all right? His name's Jean Baptiste. That's his first name. I even probably butchered that, but you know, French is hard, and I'm not about that life. But I do appreciate them helping out. Anyway, he was right next to Washington, and he was also evaluating, should we go to New York or should we go to Virginia? He actually wanted to go to Virginia, even though George Washington was not about it. As they were balancing their decisions, this was in about May, they knew that they would need the French Navy to help out no matter what. So a ship was dispatched for the French Indies to go ask this dude named de Grasse, and he was the French Rear Admiral of the Navy. He was given a note from Jean Baptiste that outlined what Washington and him were thinking. They were like, should we do New York or should we do Virginia? But he also had a little note in there that was a private note to de Grasse that was confessed. He thought Virginia was the better choice. But anyway, him and Washington, they're going to go up and check out the fortification in New York, and they'd wait to hear from de Grasse. De Grasse wasted no time. He didn't wait at all. He immediately decided he would make his way for the Chesapeake and loaded up about 3,200 troops that he borrowed from the West Indies garrison, and he just set sail. The problem, however, was that there was a lot of British Navy dudes looking for de Grasse and his fleet in the West Indies. So to avoid detection, de Grasse took a way longer route to get to Chesapeake, and he sailed out of the normal shipping lanes, which were more dangerous, and this is hurricane season, dude. He arrived at the mouth of Chesapeake on August 30th, and he was right. There was a small British fleet that was looking for him. It was headed by Sir Samuel Hood. And he figured out that, hey, de Grasse left. Like, where'd he go? So they went to see if they could find him, or at least rule out whether or not he was heading for Chesapeake. They got to the Chesapeake, though, days before de Grasse, like on August 25th, because they took a direct route and took the shipping lanes. They didn't see any ships in the mouth of Chesapeake. They didn't see any ships on the way. So they figured, hey, he must have kept going to New York. So they went on to New York. By the end of August, that small fleet got to a large New York British fleet and received word that actually de Grasse was in the Chesapeake currently. So the small fleet looked like total noobs for missing it, and they joined with the large New York fleet headed by Sir Thomas Graves. Graves, he was chilling in New York after trying to find a French convoy that was carrying tons of money and supplies for Boston. He never found the convoy. Even worse, he only had like 5 ships of the line ready for battle. A ship of the line is a sailing warship that's like the largest one. And it's literally just used in the line of battle where you like move or and unload all your broadside firepower on the boats next to you. So Graves, he had some boats, but not as many of the big mamma jammas as he would find ideal. Meanwhile, de Grasse is anchored out in the Chesapeake Bay all by his lonesome, and he sends word up to his counterpart, Barris St. Laurent in Newport, and told him the game plan. And on August 27th, the Barris set sail with 8 ships of the line, 4 frigates, and 18 transports, carrying French armaments and siege equipment for the ground forces of General George Washington to take Yorktown. But oh no, wouldn't the British fleet from New York run into Barris? Well, Barris thought this out and he was like, all right, I'm going to leave Newport, but I'm worried I'm going to get found out. So he sailed like a total weirdo in a circuitous route. And circuitous, I had to look up, apparently just means longer than the most direct way. Anyway, George Washington and my man Jean Baptiste were up in New York at this same time. They just finished scouting New York and were in total agreement that it's time to hit Virginia. New York's not about it. So to prevent the New York troops headed by Clinton, you know, the boss man of Cornwallis, they left a few surprise like troops behind on the Hudson. And that way it would look like, oh, maybe we're going to attack New York too. And that way Clinton wouldn't send down tons of aid to help Cornwallis once he heard about the attack. Once the British fleet got word that Barris left Newport, they figured out, all right, the Chesapeake is definitely where this is going down. And probably the place of attack. So let's head for there. And they set sail. Hood, who was that small fleet guy from the West Indies, he had some really crappy ships, as Graves, the guy from New York, who kind of took over his fleet and made this big mega fleet from New York, soon found out. And it took their fleet a long time to get from New York to Chesapeake, longer than it should have taken, because even though Hood was adamant that his ships were fit for a month of service, the trip to Chesapeake was just real slow going because Hood's ships needed repairs en route. Finally, they arrived at Chesapeake on the 5th of September. De Grasse, not realizing that the British were tipped off about the Chesapeake by Varys when he left his fleet from Newport, he was still offloading troops when the British fleet arrived and was caught by total surprise. Even though it took him a little bit longer, he didn't think they'd like mobilize as quickly as they did. So his fleet quickly cut to anchor. I'm talking about De Grasse here. They were on shore unloading things and they saw the British fleet. So they cut anchor, but they left hundreds of sailors and officers behind on the land. So some of the ships didn't even have enough men to staff all the guns. De Grasse and his ships were super disorganized right now, and they started heading out of the Chesapeake so they wouldn't be caught. He was also trying to buy some time for De Barris, who hadn't yet arrived because he was, you know, purposely taking his sweet time with the circuitous route. Anyway, the idea was that De Barris could unload all his siege equipment and troops, and that De Grasse was leading the British away from Yorktown area. Anyway, this plan was very spur of the moment, and the British could have just used the disorganized nature of De Grasse's escape to attack, but instead they were like, no, we have to make this exactly perfect, and we have to, like, maneuver and make the perfect line, and they squandered the opportunity. They totally should have attacked at this point. A lot of historians have looked back at this and been like, yeah, you guys were... So anyway, this gave De Grasse and his ships time to get organized for their own line, and because, you know, that's just how you fought naval battles. You just lined up parallel next to each other and just shot a bunch of cannons broadside. Anyway, each fleet kept on trying to maneuver and just get that perfect line going. Instead, they ended up meeting each other at an angle. And this angle wasn't really ideal for either party. But, you know, the front ships could engage. Just the back ships were just too far away to engage in combat. So Graves, he was the head British dude, he tried to get his ships in the perfect line by using these symbols that he would give with, like, flag commands. But he did two that simultaneously confused a lot of the ships. So Graves, his first signal meant line ahead, which told ships slowly close the gap and straighten out once they are parallel to the French. That's the ideal move, right? But his other signal that he did right after that was close action, is what it meant. And that typically indicates, hey, ships turn right now and face the enemy and just sail right at them, like your bow facing them. This move would mean the British would only have their bow guns, so it would limit their firepower, but it would get them closer and like quicker to meet the French. So Hood, he's in the back. He's a guy who was already a total noob, you know, with a small fleet from the West Indies. He's really confused by this. So he's like, what do I do? Do I meet the enemy broadside or head on? I can't do both at the same time. He interpreted the signals to mean, let's maintain the current line and we'll meet broadside. And that takes precedence over, you know, meeting them head on. So he kept sailing at a really slow angle and he never got close enough to engage. And it basically messed up a lot of things. Hood and Graves argued about these signals for the rest of their lives, and they're super mad about how, you know, confusing this whole battle was. But what this confusion meant was that most of the battle was only going to be fought by the front few ships of the fleets, and the French therefore had the advantage, because although both fleets were sailing eastward and there was like a north-northeast wind, the British were to windward, which is further north of the French fleet, if that makes more sense to you. Basically, this gave the French the advantage by allowing them to open more of their gun decks since the British fleet was blocking a lot of the surf. So now, after 6 hours of maneuvering and the British being like uber conservative, missing a few quality opportunities to fire with smaller parts of their fleet, the French just opened up on the British. 2 hours of combat ensued. Both ships took a lot of damage and the outcome was totally inconclusive. Like, who just won this? Well, it turns out the British took more damage and ended up having to scuttle one of their ships. Over the next 2 days, both fleets kept looking at each other, but none of them engaged in combat. They were both reluctant because their ships were super leaky before the battle, and now they're even worse off. So De Grasse turned back for Chesapeake, where he met up with the Barras, who just arrived from Newport, and then Graves took his British fleet, turned back for Chesapeake right behind him, but he realized he did not have enough of manpower or enough ships to take on De Grasse and Barras, so he left, went to New York, to get some repairs done and resupply. So now, the siege on Yorktown could begin, and there'd be no British fleet to bail Cornwallis out if his troops needed to evacuate. Graves planned on coming back, but by the time he set sail again, it was October, and it was actually 2 days after Cornwallis had already surrendered to Washington. It was too late. So, we owe a lot of thanks to De Grasse for the fact that we are around as a country, This dude left the West Indies on a whim with a note. Didn't even ask mainland France for permission. Didn't wait. He just left. He left the West Indies in the middle of hurricane season and sailed a way more dangerous route to avoid detection. And even the troops he brought were just a bunch of troops that he borrowed from the West Indies garrisons. And he's like, I'll bring these back to you guys. I promise. I'll get them back by the end of October. So he had like a really tight window. The historian Michael Lewis really summed up the Battle of Chesapeake. And it was a battle that could have been of little consequence if it wasn't for that Yorktown siege. But the fact that this battle happened and allowed the Yorktown siege is why it was so decisive. And it really kicked out the British Navy, who were pretty strong at the time, and just made them kind of hide in New York and bought all that precious time to make that Yorktown siege happening. So he said, before the Battle of Chesapeake, the United States was a possibility. After the battle, the United States was a certainty. So there you have it. The Chesapeake Bay saves the day, makes America great, way before anyone started to ruin it. Pretty amazing, right? All right, everybody, thank you. Tune in like a month when I release another episode. Or, you know, you can just subscribe to my podcast and then just tell you when I release new episodes because, you know, I got a full-time job. I'm in grad school. I don't really have time to do this podcast where I don't make any money off of it and I'm just kind of like doing it for the fun of it. This episode took a lot of research, so please support me by leaving a review. If you do leave a review for my podcast on iTunes and I see it, I will give you the super badass stickers I made where it has like the outline of the Chesapeake Bay, an equal sign, and then it says Bay, B-A-E. It's really nice. I really like it a lot. And I will ship them to you for free because I really appreciate your support. Thanks for listening. I'll be seeing you all Baywide. Welcome to the end of the podcast, the part where I tell you the meme of the episode, and that is where I painfully describe to you a user-generated meme, and the user is always me, and it always has to deal with the episode. So this one is all about the Battle of Chesapeake, and I selected for you a painting that is commonly referenced as like the what the hell are you talking about meme. I'll be more specific. I'll give you the backstory of it, and then I'll show you how I used it to make my meme. This is a portrait by Samuel Johnson. It's two images, one where Samuel Johnson's like really closely looking at like a newspaper in his hand and just like trying to decipher it, like kind of like squinting at it. And then the next image is of him just like looking at the portrait guy, you know, kind of like looking at the camera kind of look, where he's just like got a lip kind of slightly raised. Just so anyway, I use both those images to create this meme, and it reads, when you're fighting an important naval battle, and see two contradicting signal flags. So this is like Hood, Samuel Hood, who's in the back of the line during the Battle of the Chesapeake, and he sees the hold the line thing and then also like close in flag go up at the same time. He's like, well, what am I supposed to do? We just did nothing, cost him the whole battle, and now we're a country. So suck it. All right, have a good one.